So, in East Germany, I worked at the Academy of Science with the social scientists, and they were intrigued with me because, first of all, I had a lot to offer about the status literature in the social sciences, which they didn't have access to because they just don't have the money to buy the books. But at the same time, they watched me very carefully because there's a lot of paranoia in that state. I had a junior member of the academy look after me, but his job was not just to look after me, but I think was also to make sure that I didn't engage in activities that were threatening to the regime. So he would come with me to almost everywhere I wanted to go. I had the opportunity there, of course, to learn a good deal about the Jewish community. You know, the East Germans believe that they are themselves victims of Nazism, so they don't owe, they're not really responsible. The people who are responsible for what happened under the Nazis, they all left East Germany and ran away to the West, which is their theory. Well, in reality, of course, this is not at all true, that the communists have include many former members of the Nazi Party, not major war criminals, but people who were pretty active. And but it's probably true that persons who were directly involved in concentration camp activities, or judges of people's courts who convicted people to death for non-offenses, political offenses, probably relatively fewer of these people stayed in East Germany than in West Germany. Now, their policy towards Israel is extremely hostile at the public level. Every day in the newspaper, practically, you will find negative stories about Israel and the United States. You would get the impression, reading the East German press, that Israel must be a very large country because it is responsible for so many dastardly things. Privately, they're very apologetic. I mean, the elite, the intellectuals, they don't believe it, they know it's not true, they don't believe anything they read in their newspapers because they know that this the most carefully controlled propaganda. They read the papers only to see what the government thinks and wants them to do. This anti-Israel policy and pro-PLO policy is balanced by the daily reality that the Arab students they have are a big headache because they are much less disciplined than some other foreign students whom they have. The few Jews who remain there are treated well. There is a Jewish community. There's a head of a Jewish community. He's a physician. One of the very, I think maybe the only family that I know of, at least in East Germany, where you had a relatively young father and mother, both of whom were Jewish, and they had a child who actually was bar mitzvah, the first bar mitzvah in East Germany in a decade. And he's the head of the Jewish community, although he's a physician. And they allow him to travel and represent East German Jewry. So they also have state-supported a Jewish home for the aged, and they maintain the cemetery. The Jewish community in East Germany publishes a monthly bulletin. In other words, they want to give the impression that Judaism is vital. People who are victims of the Nazis get a double pension that includes all Jews. So for a Jewish person who is elderly, to leave East Germany means he loses all of his pension rights. And certainly on a double salary, you can live a decent life. You're not, I mean, you can't eat very well, but everything you have is taken care of. So I also visited, I had a friend from the U.S. Army who served with me in World War II, who came from Leipzig, whose father committed suicide, who was Jewish, and who was a communist. And so in 1953, during the McCarthy era, he decided to leave rather than to be invited to a public hearing. He was an author who had written a best-selling novel and a movie that was made of it. So he went to East Germany to help rebuild a socialist homeland, became quite disillusioned there, wrote many novels, got a national prize for his writings. But as his books became less friendly towards the regime, they began to put pressure on him. But they never put him in jail. So when I was there, he was not allowed to lecture to German groups. His books had disappeared from the bookstores. But he published books in West Germany, which was illegal, and one time he even had to pay a fine. But they somehow didn't want to arrest him. He was a man in the late 50s who was Jewish. He'd come voluntarily, and he knew all the top members of the Politburo, which was really his protection. But every time Helen and I visited him, we were stopped near his house. In other words, I don't think they normally followed us, although they may have been smarter than I thought they were. One of my tape recorders disappeared, and they may have taken it to because they needed a tape recorder. But in any case, every time I went to his house, we were stopped to inspect our papers, or because I was allegedly parked in the wrong direction or something. The street light in front of his house was not working, so at night he was made to feel uncomfortable. But one time when we were there and I went outside and we found that the police was waiting for us, he got so mad he cussed them out in German in a very, very aggressive fashion. I was afraid that these policemen were going to pull out their gun and shoot him. But they simply explained to him they were doing their job, that our car was parked in the wrong direction, in an area where you wouldn't know. There was no sign, one-way street. It was a villa in the woods, which the government had put at his disposal. I mean, he was definitely one of the very elite persons, and he had enough money from his salary and his books and from foreign earnings so that he could live very well. But they did allow him to travel outside the country, including Israel. In other words, they are quite ambivalent about the Jewish situation. They don't want to be perceived as being anti-Jewish, but at the same time, they want to support the Soviet Union, and this is why they are so anti-Israeli in their public pronouncement and feel guilty at the private level about it.
Dr. Eaton, I believe you recently returned from an assignment in the Philippines.
Well, I recently returned from a visit to Asia, many Asian countries.
Asia and the Philippines. Uh-huh.
To visit schools of public administration.
I see.
And that took us to the Philippines and Malaysia and Thailand and Singapore and Nepal and India, Pakistan, and Abu Dhabi.
Under whose auspices was
the university?
I see.
School. But there I also had an opportunity to learn some very interesting things about the Jewish communities in the areas, as well as the role of Israel. So for example, the Philippines, Israel has an embassy. But in Malaysia and in Indonesia, they do not, because both of them are Muslim countries. In fact, Indonesia is the biggest Muslim country in the world, 170 million Muslims. But in these countries, while they are sympathetic with the Palestinians, they are very cautious not to get involved too much, because They don't like terrorism. And while we were traveling, President Herzog was making a tour of Asia. President Herzog of Israel. The Philippines, in the last minute, canceled his visit because Mrs. Aquino, I think, was afraid of a disturbance, and she just didn't feel secure enough to handle that. But the Prime Minister of Singapore received President Herzog, and it was a very big occasion. And the interesting thing is that neither the Indonesians nor the Malaysians cut diplomatic relations, which some of the more extreme Muslims wanted them to, because Singapore insulted them by receiving the President of Israel. And the information that was given to me by high officials was that they did not wish to continue this confrontation. They wish it would settle down, and they felt it was an internal affair of Singapore and of Nepal if they wanted to host the President of Israel, and they should not compromise their own diplomatic relationships because of this. Something that would have been not the case, let's say, 5 years ago.
Dr. Eaton, we'd like to return to your personal and family life and learn something about your children. Could you give us their names and birth dates?
Well,
so on.
Let's start with the youngest.
All right. Start me where you
Jonathan, were. Whose birthday was yesterday.
I see.
And he's 31.
And what is he doing presently?
Well, Jonathan, somebody who has never liked to work for a boss. He doesn't like to be bossed around. He has wanted to be on his own and was independent as early as grade school. This has continued. So he organized a magazine, published it, called Career Insights. A very fancy and well-produced magazine addressing itself to the career interests of graduates of Ivy League colleges, and it's financed by advertisements from key companies that recruited these Ivy League colleges, and it is distributed by the universities through their mail system free. So he's engaged in that particular effort. Right now he is working to refinance the company because he wants to publish it more often and he needs more capital.
Is he married?
He's not married.
I see. And next in line?
Next is a young lady called Deborah. She is married, living in Houston. Her husband directs an investment office of IDS, in Minneapolis. The investment branch of what is now American Express. She is a health educator. Mm-hmm. They've been married 2 years and still act as if they were honeymooners.
How nice.
And she is 33. They have made a very interesting life in Houston, which is not the best and most interesting city to live in.
No children there?
No children at the moment. And then the third is named Seth. Seth is married, he has two children, and lives in Laurel, Maryland. He went to the School of Medicine here at the university and then interned in Washington, and his wife is a lawyer who specializes in health maintenance organizations and in health law. So they live near Washington so that she can continue to work part-time, and he has now a private practice in pediatrics and in general medicine in Laurel. He gets a great deal of satisfaction not only out of his medicine, because the combination of those two specialties is more interesting to him than if he were only a pediatrician, where you really, after a while, you just get very bored because you see the same relatively healthy problems. But he also has developed a computer program and is working closely with the individual who is improving it to conduct the medical practice by maximum reliance on computers, so that not only are all of his records, but all of his bills are done by computer, and he's able to maintain a high degree of control over patients, so that when he can put in the computer when they need an appointment or a shot, and all of these things are done automatically, so that the amount of time needed for clerical work and administrative work
reduced?
Is very much reduced, yes.
So you have two grandchildren there.
I have two grandchildren.
How old are they?
They're 6 and 3.
I see.
And my mother-in-law, who lives with us, she's 92, just came back from a visit in Laurel and has lots of stories to tell about the adventures of a 3-year-old, of one of the babysitters got fed up with the two kids because they weren't quite listening to her, and she said, "Well, I can't handle you people. I'm just going to leave if you don't behave yourself." So a minute later, little Daniel comes up and hands her her purse and says, "Go."
He took her literally. Now that leaves us with your oldest son.
The oldest is a professor at the University of Texas in Austin, Texas, in environmental engineering. And this is a job that was very satisfying. When he graduated from Johns Hopkins University, he had a number of offers, but he chose Texas because it is a school that is well-financed and has some very important senior people, nationally important people, because the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, in which he is a professor, got help from the Johnson family and inherited some of the outstanding New Dealers that served under President Johnson. So he was one of the first junior people to join that faculty, and this has been a good place for him to work.
Is he married, Dr.
Eaton? Not at the moment. He's not been married before, but whether he will be married in the near future is something that is, let's say, a statistical possibility.
So that leaves
What's
you
his
with...
name?
Huh? David.
That leaves you with two grandchildren. Delightful.
That's right.
Could you contrast the way you were raised with the way you raised these children regarding experiences, mobility, permissiveness, and so on? They had a totally different background, didn't they?
Well, first of all, when I was young, we had a maid looking after me and my brothers much of the day, although my mother was not working. My wife didn't like household help. She found that it was more bother to have somebody in the house supposedly helping her, than so often you've got people who just weren't very good, and yet you spent your time training them. If they were very good, they would leave. So she didn't like household help. So our children were raised by, had much more contact, I think, with their mother than I had, although my mother was home full time. My father was a businessman who traveled a great deal, so he had relatively little input, whereas myself took much more time with the children. I'm sure they don't feel enough time, but the whole relationship between husband and wife changed, and so that husbands, whether it's being able to cook or taking children to various places,
involved.
Are much more involved, and certainly my children had that experience. My parents weren't interested in sports, and I'm afraid their father, my children, also missed being made to feel enthusiastic about baseball or basketball, because we didn't watch it at home, and I never took them to a baseball game. But I think I've been forgiven that. They're not interested much in baseball
They don't feel deprived.
No, no. Occasionally, I think they may watch a football game, but very rarely. From point of view of background, they certainly became interested in many of the things we are interested in, especially, not all of them, but the two older boys and the youngest, the boys, are really very much interested in public affairs.
Well, they did spend a great deal of time in Israel, didn't they?
Well, they spent a year in Israel, all of them. And the two oldest ones learned Hebrew, and the oldest one learned it so well that he still speaks it, and he can lecture in Hebrew.
He just hasn't
forgotten it. The two youngest ones also were with us in Israel in the 70s when I directed the School of Social Work. The two older ones were going to college at that time. They came to visit, but they weren't living at home at that time.
Dr. Eaton, are you currently affiliated with Jewish institutions and organizations in the city, synagogues and so on?
I'm a member of the board of directors of the Community Relations Committee, by virtue of the fact that I was at one point its chairman. And so for a certain number of years after you're chairman, you remain a UJF appointee, and I've been once was on the Planning and Budget Committee of the Federation. I belong to the Zionist organization and Bnei B'rith simply because it's hard to say no to people who spend their time wanting you to become members, but I don't have really time to participate in these organizations, nor would I find their activities very interesting.
But this is offer some
support. So I give talks, but I just don't have enough evenings to go to the meetings, and they're mostly activities in which people are of most of them my age. They have unfortunately not many younger persons find a great deal of social satisfaction, and I just don't. I have enough things happening in my life not to have time, so.
Are you affiliated with any synagogue?
No.
I see. How do you view Pittsburgh's Jewish life and its place in the general community today?
Well, there's no question that Pittsburgh's 45,000 Jews play a very significant role in the community life of the city, far beyond their number. And I think it is related not only to the educational background, which the average education, I think, of Jews is probably very high. After all, since World War II, most Jewish families moved out of the working class, that were working class people, into the middle class, so that today the Jewish community, other than elderly persons, it's relatively few people who are in an economically marginal role. But it's also that the Jewish community, and because of the background and education of many Jews, plays an active role in just about every community activity. In the United Fund, in the cultural life, you go to lectures of public interest and you find large numbers of Jews, so that there's no doubt that the Jewish community has a both cultural and political influence way beyond its numbers. I think these realities are generally appreciated. Squirrel Hill is an area where you have many prominent Jews and many prominent community leaders living in the same community. This is not true in most parts of the country, where you have a section that is really the where you might say 50% leaders of the community at large and 50% Jews, plus I should say 50, because you also have increasing numbers of students, persons who are from foreign nations, who like to move into this kind of a community because they're more accepted here. Mm-hmm. than, I mean, an Indian or black family living in Squirrel Hill is much more comfortable than if they moved into most other middle-class communities in the city. In fact, I would say in all other middle-class communities in the city, where they would find much less warmth and acceptance, and their children would have reported more difficulty in the schools. Although Pittsburgh is not a city in which you have strong segregationist sentiments that enjoy much political support.
What about anti-Semitism?
Well, I believe anti-Semitism needs to be viewed in terms of the fact that there are many elements in the United States which have accepted Jews as they would accept anyone else. It's reflected in the number of Jews who get elected to public office, the freedom with which Jews interact with the rest of the community, in which they are accepted in corporations today, and the freedom the Jewish community feels in standing up publicly for things that interest us. People don't mind speaking out, and I have had no problem in writing letters to the press or the Post-Gazette and get them printed, op-ed pieces on Jewish matters. So I believe the Jewish community in the United States, more than any other Jewish community in history, enjoys a place in the civic body. At the same time, there are anti-Semitic traditions that are widespread. As I may have mentioned in my interview, that my first job was denied to me because I was Jewish. It wouldn't happen at Penn State University today, but it did happen in 1948.
You have to view that as progress.
And you have many fringe groups that engage in anti-Jewish discussions on the radio and the press. Letters, occasionally violence, so that I think any young Jewish person growing up, and my children certainly are aware of this, will confront people who find Jews strange, believe that we are dangerous, hateful, un-American, and so on. But I do believe that this has to be seen in the context of the overriding reality that Jews are making it in this country on the basis of their personal abilities. And then it would be unfortunate if Jews become too preoccupied with the fact that there are anti-Semites. You can't go through life and be successful without having enemies. And it would be sad if we become so overridden by paranoia that we are afraid to interact freely by virtue of this fact.
You must take a balance view.
So, you know, yes, the Duquesne Club never admitted Jews, now has a few Jews just to be able to say they don't discriminate. But I'm very happy with the fact that not so many Jews are trying to get into the Duquesne Club because they don't deserve it. Very soon the Duquesne Club will have the same fate as some of the other clubs in the city, that they don't have enough members who are willing to pay membership, though they have to take in anybody. This is what happened to the university club. When I came to Pittsburgh University, the administration had membership in the university club until some of us decided.